Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the December 2nd edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is Lake Tahoe's Bear Boom by Paige Williams. Wildfires, overdevelopment, and easy access to garbage have brought Tahoe's bears into increasingly close contact with their human neighbors. One local described a bear as a 500-pound police battering ram. U.S. Journal, Lake Tahoe's Bear Boom. The vacation hotspot has been overrun by people whose habits are drawing fast-moving animals with sharp claws and insatiable appetites. By Paige Williams. Lake Tahoe, the jewel of the Sierra Nevada, is an unusually clear, deep alpine lake that is 12 miles wide and 22 miles long. It straddles two states, California on the west shore, which is damper and greener, and Nevada on the east, which gives way almost immediately to high desert, a kind of heaven John Muir called Tahoe. In 1878, after raving about the diameter of its snowflakes and lusty exercise on snowshoes, Tahoe is about a third of the size of Yosemite National Park, yet attracts three times the number of annual visitors. During the pandemic, several thousand people, including a lot of Bay Area tech types, fully relocated to the lake, joining 70,000 or so locals. Tahoe couldn't handle it. The traffic, the noise, the illegal parking, the trash. Last year's 4th of July crowds left an unprecedented 4 tons of garbage on the beaches alone. Photos named Lake Tahoe one of the world's natural attractions that could use a break in order to heal and rejuvenate, and suggested that outsiders avoid visiting for a while. The other day in Tahoe, I learned a new word, touron, a combination of tourist and moron. The Tahoe Basin is also home to one of the continent's densest populations of black bears, Ursus americanus. The species flourished after its chief predator, the grizzly, was extirpated there in the early 20th century. Grizzlies are not to be fucked with. Black bears, which can be brown, reddish, or blonde, are defensive and lazy, smart and resilient, ravenous and opportunistic. All they really want to do is eat. They lived mostly on grasses, berries, and insects until humans showed up. Why spend all day dismantling a yellow jacket nest for the paltry reward of larvae when there's a dumpster pizza to be had? Even if something is not edible, bears will try to eat it. Scented air fresheners, cherry lip balm. The black bear is the terrestrial equivalent of a shark, the sharpest nose in the ocean. Its sense of smell is 7 times better than a bloodhound's, several thousand times better than a human's. A bear that detects so much as a tic-tac will remember the location of that score forever and teach it to her cubs. Think about the wrappers in your car, the candy in your pocket, in your backpack, in your tent, the stuff behind your garage door. They can smell all of that, even if it's unopened cans, unopened wine bottles, beer bottles, a California State Parks employee said in September at Tahoe's inaugural Bear Fest, a public event about how not to be stupid in bear country. It is illegal to feed a bear, no matter how cuddly or sickly it looks, or how strong the impulse to Instagram. Unsecured trash exposes bears to the intestinal torments of metal and glass. One recent afternoon, a bear advocate named Kathy Zollinger and I were walking in the woods at the south end of Lake Tahoe when she pointed out what resembled a giant cookie oatmeal cookie with silver sprinkles, bear poo flecked with tinfoil. Bear scat often contains plastic. Bears aren't opening the bag gingerly to get what's inside it, Zollinger said. Dozens of bears are hit by cars every year in Tahoe. A bear that gets comfortable around humans may become increasingly brazen. One day it's at the hummingbird feeder, the next it's at your fridge. Through no fault of its own, the bear could become a target for euthanasia. A fed bear is a dead bear, wildlife biologists like to say. In autumn, bears enter hyperphagia. They must eat at least 20,000 calories, the equivalent of 36 Big Macs, a day before they den. The females are on a deadline to store enough fat to sustain themselves and a pregnancy until spring. Though in Tahoe, where there's plenty of touron food year-round, bears hardly have to hibernate anymore. Bears have learned how to unscrew lids. They know how to open sliding glass doors. They'll prowl from car to car, trying handles. Ryan Welch, the founder of Tahoe's oldest bear deterrent company, Bear Busters, told me about a woman who reported her Prius missing. The police found the car at the bottom of the hill that she parked it on, with the bear inside. Bears have learned that they can wander onto a crowded beach and help themselves to picnic food, with humans standing feet away, casually videoing, and that they can spook hikers into dropping their snack-filled packs. This spring, a bear snatched a construction worker's cooler from the bed of a pickup and ate the man's lunch in front of him. A Tahoe friend of mine once turned her back while unloading groceries and lost a 15-pound Christmas roast. The bear left nothing but a greasy scrap of butcher paper in the driveway. A black bear's short, curved claws function as miniature crowbars, capable of leveraging the slightest crevice to pry open a window or to shred a garage door. An unsecured crawl space is an invitation. A bear will make confetti of a door jamb. In vacant houses, which are plentiful in resort communities like Tahoe, bears turn on faucets and burners, usually by bumbling into them. Last year, a utility company employee noticed a spike in water use at one home. Bears had moved in. They had defecated everywhere. The walls and carpet were covered in mold, another state employee said at Bear Fest. Bears that den beneath homes and businesses can dislodge insulation and wiring, some of which keeps the pipes from freezing. Bears are capable of breaking down anything they want in their quest for calories, Welch told me. There's nothing bear-proof. I don't care how thick a door is or if it's metal. I describe a bear as a 500-pound police battering ram. The person who clued me in to Torrens was Devin Baroni, a Marin County native who recently finished her graduate studies in natural resources at Oregon State University with a special interest in human-wildlife conflict. Baroni, who is 30, has mermaid hair and a tattoo of diving penguins. She wears balloon pants from Kathmandu and drinks yerba mate out of a handmade granite cap that she brought home from Chile, where she used to live. In May, Baroni began working as the executive assistant to Ann Bryant, who co-founded a Tahoe nonprofit called Bear League in 1998 after a government trapper enraged the community by killing a mother bear and her cub and then lying about it. The animals had not been relocated as the trapper had claimed. Bryant introduced Baroni to the league's 146,000 Facebook followers by saying that she had studied and traveled all over the world, learning about people's complex relationships with everything from elephants to mountain lions and other large and sometimes misunderstood and often feared animals. BEAR stands for Bear Education Aversion Response. Bryant, who is in her 70s, has spent the past 25 years showing Tahoeans how to avoid attracting bears and what to do if they fail. About 200 of the league's 2,500 members are trained to respond to calls. We answer 24/7, she told me. Bryant herself may show up to fire a paintball gun, flush a bear from a crawl space, harangue a human to keep a clean grill, and bring in the birdseed at night. Bryant worked in wildlife rehabilitation before starting Bear League, but these days she's more likely to lean on her college studies in psychology. When someone sees a bear on their lawn or at their door or in their kitchen, it can be hard to remember in the moment that the average black bear can be treed by a chihuahua and that a bear's huffing, bluff charging, grunting, and teeth clacking are usually nothing more than messages to back off. The correct human response is confidence and noise. Yell, raise your arms, look big. Never turn your back on a bear. Stand your ground, but also slowly retreat. Never block a bear's exit. Bears leave the same way they came in. Bryant tells people you gotta be aggressive, dominant, mean. Around Tahoe, Bryant is known as the Bear Lady because she is always talking about bears or being talked about for talking about bears. She has appeared on PBS, the BBC, Animal Planet, National Geographic, and in countless local newscasts. Her bright blonde hair, worn long with bangs, is so distinctive that I wondered if it was a wig until the wind blew and I saw scalp. Bryant is a native Minnesotan of Scandinavian heritage. Every time I visited her, she had on black leggings, a black hoodie, and black Crocs. Even indoors and always on TV, she wears gold-rimmed sunglasses and fingerless leather gloves, beige one day, black the next. They reminded me of bear paws. One California elected official told me of Bear League. Politically, they're very powerful. The state euthanizes fewer bears today than it has in generations past, in part because Bear League and other organizations like it has pushed wildlife agencies to be more judicious. They kill, we save, Bryant said. Bryant implores humans to adjust their own behavior instead of expecting wild animals to change. At the end of her driveway stands a steel garbage bin that resembles a large safe, a bear box. Bear League has long advocated for the boxes to become standard throughout Tahoe, often encountering resistance from residents who dislike the way they look. In Tahoe Keys, a private marina community, the HOA rejected bear boxes because homeowners were worried about parking and snow storage in their small, densely spaced lots, and because they didn't want to see a wall of steel. Then in late 2021 and early 2022, dozens of Keys homes had break-ins. Neighbors blamed a 500-pound bear that everyone called Hank the Tank. Hank turned out to be female, and she wasn't the only culprit. Two other known bears were in the area. They had been drawn there at the start of the pandemic when garbage pickup was suspended, and when in 2021 a bullet ignited a wildfire that destroyed nearly 222,000 acres of nearby forest. After the entire town of South Lake Tahoe evacuated, bears wandered through the orange haze, searching the hastily abandoned buildings for food. Bryant lives in Homewood on the West Shore, in a bungalow with a vertiginous copper roof. Her property is lakefront once removed, the water just visible from her deck. She moved to Tahoe decades ago with her husband at the time, who later decided that high altitudes and wild animals weren't for him, and decamped to South Padre Island, Texas. Much of Bryant's front yard is eternally and perfectly green because it is golf course turf. You don't mow it, you vacuum it. She installed the lawn because the forest canopy was too thick for grass to grow, and she got sick of mud. Around the property are little seating areas, as in a cemetery. In summer, Bryant can often be found beneath a massive cedar drinking a Red Bull or a margarita. Lots of Tahoeans have festive white globe lights strung across their outdoor spaces. Bryant's are red. Nearly all of Bear League's finances come from donations. Years ago, major contributors, along with the group's treasurer, encouraged the creation of an endowment, which has grown to nearly $2.5 million. Bryant, who takes no salary, told me, "Our plan was to not break into this piggy bank until I'm gone." She has been called the Mother Teresa of Bears and a fanatic. Twice, the league has been sued for harassment and defamation. In 2015, a Tahoe couple claimed to have received death threats from people associated with the league, after a Nevada Department of Wildlife officer euthanized a bear that had broken into their car. In 2017, the agency official in charge of bear trapping and euthanasia, Carl Lackey, accused the league and the administration of two Facebook pages, Lake Tahoe Wall of Shame and NDOW Watch, keeping them transparent, of participating in a smear campaign against him. In one of the Facebook comments cited in the suit, the league claimed, without evidence, that Lackey took under-the-table cash for bringing trophy bears into the hunt zone. Both Nevada and California allow seasonal bear hunting in designated areas. Another commentator wrote, maybe time for assassination. Lackey dropped his case against the league, but went on suing the other defendants and lost. The Nevada Commission on Ethics reprimanded him for trying to use his government position to crowdfund his legal bills, and last year a judge ordered him to pay more than $150,000 to cover his opponent's expenses and various court costs. This and other conflicts have contributed to an undercurrent of old beefs in Tahoe's bear community. The league's only full-time staff member is Bernie, who lives rent-free in a tiny house on the side of Bryant's driveway. A studio apartment above Bryant's two-car garage serves as Bear League headquarters. The league used to train dozens of volunteers each year. Bryant now selects only a handful, She says this allows her to get to know and better manage the people she's working with. Her den-like domain reflects what she calls her reclusive personality. Before founding the League, she said, "I did my grocery shopping during the dead of night because I didn't like crowds of people." One Sunday morning, I got a text from Brian saying that the League had just received a call about a bear that had nearly been hit by a car on the road that rings the lake. "It's Bernardo," she wrote. A state wildlife biologist recently told me, "We don't name bears. Tahoeans do name them. Clementine, Tiny Tim, Buddha Mom, Julie, Baldy, Lupita, Sunny, Za." Bryant claims to recognize individual bears the way we humans recognize one another. A bear may have a distinctive muzzle or a patch of colored chest fur. A bear with an old injury may limp. "They have personalities," Bryant said. "Each one of them is unique in their own way, intelligent in their own way, goofy in their own way, just like we are." Bryant dispatched a volunteer, Mason Baleson, to shoo the bear deeper into the forest. By the time he arrived, the bear had moved near the trailhead of a popular mountain biking corridor. "When I got there, cyclists were unloading gear from their vehicles and setting out on rides, and Baleson was sitting behind the wheel of a small SUV marked Bear League, its hazards flashing. 30 yards away, a large bear lay in the woods the way a Labrador might rest between fetches. "I've been watching him rip apart pine cones," Baleson told me after we got out of our cars. "This is good behavior for him, to be over here eating all these nuts and stuff." The bear heard us, lifted his head, stood up, sat down, scratched his chin with a hind paw, then got back on his feet and went on eating. Baleson walked toward him, clapping and yelling, "Come on, Bernardo!" The bear bounded off. Afterward, Baleson stopped by the League's office to grab a bear mat, a strip of rubber and metal wired to a small transformer mat. This is also called an unwelcome mat. Baleson loaded it into his truck and drove it to a house nearby. I followed him through a cluttered side yard to where the property owner, whose name was Greg, stood staring up at a broken window. Enormous paw prints climbed the wall. Greg, a general contractor in his 70s, lived at the house and among other properties that he and his wife Kathy were remodeling. Their dog, which reliably scared bears away, had died over the summer. On Friday, a bear had tried to get into the house. On Saturday, Greg had run a bear off by using bear spray and throwing rocks. This morning, he had come home to find that a bear had finally succeeded. "The kitchen is just strewn," he told me. "I got a 40-pound bag of cat food, a thing of roasted garlic, my package of cookies. It got into the coffee. It got into a 5-gallon bucket that Kathy saves butterscotch and chocolate chips and stuff in. Didn't eat a lot of those, but it spread them all over the floor. It didn't get into the honey. It got into the olive oil. I've come into houses where a bear has torn the range hood off, torn the microwave off. The shelves are all broken and everything's collapsed, or the doors are gone and the whole cabinet's off the wall. Turned over refrigerators. A house here burned down because a bear broke in and knocked the stove over. The electric igniters went off. It tore the gas line open. Gas started spewing. I heard the snapping and popping. It's 10:30 at night and I'm going, 'What the hell?' I walked out to the street and I could see the flames. By then, the whole house was engulfed. The fire department saved the foundation." Insurance companies usually cover property damage caused by bears, though it is becoming harder to get some types of insurance in California because of wildfires. Recently, an insurer received a claim that a bear had vandalized a Rolls-Royce. Investigators showed security footage of the incident to a wildlife biologist, who determined that the perpetrator was a human in a bear costume. Additional claims were filed for other luxury cars. 4 people have been charged with fraud. Greg's bear had used its upper body strength to reach the window, which stood about 7 feet off the ground, with nothing below it. Greg said if it got its head up high enough to butt the window, it would have shattered it immediately. "They have the strength of like 10 football players," Baleson offered. "They could probably lift a car up if they wanted to," Greg said. "I mean, they can tear a door off a car. And then they can fit their bodies into anything they can put their heads through," Baleson said. Greg told me, "You'd be absolutely amazed at how fast they move. See that fence? See the stump? I've seen a bear at a full tilt run, jump on that, vault its back legs onto the fence, and then roll over the top of it that fast. Usain Bolt topped out at 27.8 miles an hour. Bears can hit 30. Greg was awed, not angry. Bears are just trying to live, and this is free food. So if you don't protect it, it's your fault. Greg now had no choice but to fortify his property. Holding a cordless screwdriver, he said, I should have done this years ago, but I was trying to make a living and handle two kids going to college. He climbed a teetering metal ladder, wearing a cannula in his nose and a portable oxygen tank on his belt. He just told me, let's see, I have neuropathy, kidney disease, diabetes, PTSD, COPD, tinnitus. My eyes are almost shot. Ballison handed up rectangles of plywood, sheet by sheet. Greg bolted the panels to the window like a triptych. Ballison had brought the bear mat from his truck. He now positioned it beneath the window and showed Greg how it worked. An animal that steps on a bear mat receives a nasty zap. So does a barefoot human. Welch, the Bear Busters founder, an electrical contractor in his 40s, came up with the device 14 years ago when he was servicing and repairing hot tubs for a living and kept finding the aftermath of bear break-ins at clients' unoccupied houses. Home remedies such as Pine Sol and these ridiculous motion-sensored dog-barking machines were no longer effective. One day, Welch noticed an electric fence, the kind that ranchers used to contain livestock, and parlayed that principle into the bear mat. He said people would tell me, what are you going to do when this kills my kids? I look at them and say, I'm licensed and insured as a contractor. Do you think I'd be insured if this was dangerous? We do not have fried tourists all over the place. The shock wounds only the pride. A bear mat typically goes for a few hundred dollars. Welch has sold around 5,000 of them and is now on the third iteration. The mats are getting lighter, prettier, and more customizable. Black bears can be found throughout the United States, and lately Welch has been shipping mats to Connecticut and South Carolina. Customers place them anywhere that they don't want bears: stairs, doorsteps, garages, surrounding a parked car. On the Bear Busters YouTube channel, home security videos of noticeable jolts have been viewed nearly 2 million times. One shows a man on all fours searching for a house key and recoiling, son of a bitch, when he gets zapped. In the comments, someone suggested using bear mats to thwart porch pirates. Bear League buys electric mats and bolt, then loans and sometimes delivers them for free to anyone who asks. The devices should work until bears figure out how to wear shoes. Welch also created bear wires, thin electrified cables that are strung horizontally across windows and doors. They attach like bungee cords, and like the mats, can be switched off and on from the inside or outside a residence. Welch drove me around the lake's west shore and showed me some of the thousands of places that he has wired, from a property so exclusive that I'm not allowed to say more to cabins that appeared abandoned. People don't always love how the wires look, but the alternative is a bear in your house. Zollinger, the bear advocate, who oversees the league's volunteers in South Lake Tahoe, told me, I heard someone say, we shouldn't have to turn our houses into fortresses because of bears. To me, yeah, if you want to live in Lake Tahoe, you need to secure the home so that bears don't come in. That's the responsible thing to do. We live in the forest. People call and say, I've lived here 30, 40, 50 years, and I've never had a problem with bears. I'm like, well, now we have fires, and they have no habitat anymore, and we continue to develop. A small wiring job must cost a couple of $1,000s, a large one tens of thousands. Bear Busters stays busy. I spent most of one Monday watching Welch count entry points on dwellings and fill out cost estimates on an iPad. He has only 8 employees but struggles to keep them. Tahoe lost a lot of its affordable housing during the pandemic. Many lower wage earners now have to commute from Reno and Carson City if they choose to continue working in Tahoe. Businesses have had to cut back on their hours for lack of staff. Welch said, our cost of living here has quadrupled in the past 5 years since COVID started and the tech industry decided they're living up here full time. Welch is lanky with stick straight blonde hair and light eyes. He had on jeans, a big buckled belt, and a long sleeved t-shirt, a baseball cap, and hiking boots, and was driving an unmarked white utility truck. I followed him to a scrum of boxy white clapboard rental cottages with forest green trim, which the owner, Eric Mason, described as old school Tahoe. Mason lives in Sacramento and sells chargers for electric vehicles. When his parents bought the cottages in 1973, bears rarely came around. Now they regularly show up at the windows and doors. Welch looked at several bungee cords that had been stretched across the cottage's stairs and politely avoided saying how pointless they were. Another DIY solution looked medieval, plywood sheets spiked with nails. Welch and Mason walked around searching for outlets. Bear mats and wires have to be plugged in. We passed an apple tree and on one stoop a potted vine loaded with cherry tomatoes, which were now impossible to see as anything other than bait. I wondered aloud whether bears ever go in through the roof. I've seen them go in through a skylight, Welch said. Dropped 20 feet through the house, then ransacked it and broke a window to get out. Like, how'd they not break a leg with that? They're very athletic, Mason said. Between 2017 and 2020, humans in Tahoe reported, on average, 674 encounters with bears per year. That number more than doubled between 2021 and 2022. It's possible that more people are reporting their experiences. Last year, when Bogdan and Stephanie Yamkovenko moved to Tahoe from Washington, D.C., their next-door neighbor, Randall Toby, warned them about bears, which had broken into his house a few years back and made a mess. The Yamkovenks considered bears a bonus. They worked from home for Khan Academy, the online education company, and had chosen Tahoe because they wanted to live in a place where they could easily take long walks with their 100-pound dog, a Bouvier de Flandre named Balthazar. Their rental house in South Lake Tahoe backed up to a forest that had been devastated by the wildfire in 2021. On the day that I visited, this part of the woods lay golden and still. The Yamkovenkos had a second-floor deck with a barbecue grill and an umbrella table where they liked taking calls and eating meals. Next day, they could see Toby's place, a one-story cottage with antlers mounted over the entrances. Toby, a semi-retired landscaper in his 60s, who used to work ski patrol at some of the local resorts, had lived there since the early 90s. The Yamkovenkos liked him well enough until they heard him refer to bears as pests and describe them as worse than gophers. It surprised and dismayed them to find themselves living alongside the kind of Tahoan who showed no interest in coexisting with wildlife. By law, a property owner can ask the state for a depredation permit to kill a problem bear, though in 2022, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife began prioritizing a non-lethal approach and attempting to educate residents about alternatives, such as keeping doors and windows either electrified or locked. Relocating bears doesn't work, they just come back. The state was issuing fewer and fewer permits, 328 in 2017, 53 last year, and permit holders hardly ever killed as many bears as they were authorized to. The Yamkovenkos could not fathom killing even one. We're very much okay with bears because they're not aggressive, Bogdan told me. They run away. They don't come to you. They don't antagonize you. This spring, a blonde yearling started sniffing around Yamkovenko's back door. Yearlings are bears that have just separated from their mothers. A Californian wildlife official recently described them as really clueless young teenage bears getting kicked out of the nest and doing whatever they can to survive. The couple took photos and videos but kept their distance, marveling at the fact that this bear was smaller than their dog. On Memorial Day, the Yamkovenkos spent the morning watching the yearlings sleep on a high branch of a lodgepole pine in Toby's backyard. They were about to sit down to lunch when they saw the bear scamper down the tree and stroll over to Toby's house, then poke its nose through the open door. Bogdan banged on the lid of his grill to scare it off. The yearling looked up but didn't leave. Bogdan saw the bear inch forward, then back out of the house and run. That's when I heard the first shot, he said. Bogdan sprinted over to Toby's place, screaming, "What are you doing?" A second shot. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. "Don't do anything," Bogdan said when he told Toby, who replied, "No, I gotta put him out of his misery." As Toby raised his rifle, Bogdan turned his head. A state game warden arrived, along with a deputy from the El Dorado County Sheriff's Department. Toby had already called 911 to report that he had just shot a bear that had come into his home and threatened him and his dog. "He scared me," Toby reportedly told the dispatcher. The sheriff refused to release the 911 audio to me. "It is a felony to intentionally kill a bear without a hunting license for any reason other than self-defense." Investigators concluded that Toby had no choice but to shoot because the bear was inside his house, a finding that did not fully match what the Yankonovics had witnessed. They'd never lost sight of the bear's hind legs. The couple tried to put themselves in the mindset of someone who panicked at the sight of a bear at the door and concluded that, even if rattled, Toby might have made other choices. "He could have just thrown his shoe or the remote control or a water bottle," Stephanie told me. Bear League would have provided electric mats for free. She and Bogdan had been hoping to buy a house in the neighborhood, but now they just wanted to move. Seeing bears in the backyard was no longer this magical thing, Stephanie said. The young Yankonovics had hung a sail shade on their deck to avoid having to look at Toby. It bothered them that his version of the story became accepted as a fact in the media based on what they considered a flawed investigative report. They worried that others would emulate him. "One afternoon, I went to Toby's house and found his storm door propped open. The inner door, wooden with a brass knocker shaped like a fish, was closed. I knocked with the fish, and Toby came to the door with a shy mutt named Rosie. Toby had white hair and brown eyes. He stood with a slight bend in his knees, like a skier still in his boots, chewing on a shard of venison jerky. When I asked about the bear, he reflexively looked away, raising his hands like a person under arrest, and said, 'I just didn't feel good about it at all. It was bad news all the way around.' For a second, this tracked as regret. I asked Toby if he'd killed the bear, if he had to do it all over again. 'Yeah,' he said. 'Fuck, it was in my kitchen.' I asked why he kept his door open. He said, 'When it's 80 degrees out and you don't have air conditioning, you've got to open up everything.' Last year, throughout the spring and summer, bears were strolling around Downeyville, an old gold-rich town 70 miles northwest of the lake that has reinvented itself as a mountain biking destination. Downtown, where the North Yuba River forks, there's a grocer, a theater, a bike shop, and above a hair salon, the offices of the Mountain Messenger, California's oldest continuously operated weekly newspaper, where Samuel Clemens supposedly published a few items before becoming Mark Twain. The bears in town weren't necessarily showing aggression toward people, Mike Fisher, the sheriff of Sierra County, said recently, but they weren't afraid of people. That fall, a retired contractor named Patrice Miller, who rented a yellow frame house on a wooded lot near downtown, swatted a bear away from her window, describing it as a big bastard. Miller was 71 and lived alone. She grew orchids and dyed her own knitting yarn and with chrysanthemums and tree bark, and in her above-ground basement, she had set up a wood shop. She had moved to Downeyville a decade earlier from the coast. Miller was aware of bears because early on, a couple who lived across the street, Robert Hall, co-captain of the fire department, and his wife Patty, had warned her about them. She said, 'Oh, it'll be fine. I have my air horns,' Patty told me. One day, a neighbor was reporting a problem bear to the state's wildlife hotline and mentioned that Miller may want help too. A game warden contacted Miller to see if she was interested in a depredation permit. Miller ultimately declined. 'She liked all animals,' Patty told me. The warden, having learned that Miller's house was dilapidated and full of garbage, cautioned her to keep the property clean and to stop feeding her cats on the porch. Instead, Miller installed iron bars on her kitchen windows. She apparently also leaned a heavy beam against another entrance. Miller routinely walked to the grocery, which a friend owned, to buy alcohol. In early November, the grocer called the sheriff to say that she hadn't seen Miller in days. The Halls were already wondering why Miller's porch light no longer came on at night. A sheriff's deputy, Malcolm Faden, went to the house on the afternoon of November 8th. On the front steps, he found a punctured garden hose, spurting water. He turned off the spigot and went to the door. When he looked through the window and saw blood on the floor, he drew his service weapon and stepped inside. In the living room, Faden found bear scat, a foot in diameter. In the kitchen, he found Miller dead. Her naked body was gashed with claw marks. Her left arm and most of her right leg had been eaten down to the bone. The security bars on the window hung by a single bolt. The cabinets were destroyed. In the bedroom, Faden saw paw prints and soil, and on the bed, feces and urine. Miller's laptop was still plugged in and open. Faden wrote in his report that she appeared to have been dragged off her bed after she was already dead. That afternoon, the Department of Fish and Wildlife sent a game warden, Zeke Aubrey. Game wardens are sworn peace officers who primarily enforce conservation laws, but may also handle matters involving public safety. Aubrey and Faden met at the sheriff's office, where Faden explained what was going on and, according to Fish and Wildlife case notes, raised the possibility that a bear had potentially killed Miller. They went to the scene where Miller's body still lay in the kitchen next to a couple of crushed soup cans. Aubrey noted large pools of blood and bloody drag marks in the living room and the presence of fat and skin throughout the house. He sent the soup cans and swabs from three of Miller's wounds to a forensics lab for DNA testing. In the days that followed, neighbors reported that a bear was still hanging around Miller's house. On November 13th, Fisher, the sheriff, called a state wildlife official to ask permission to set a bear trap there, and was told that only the homeowner or the tenant could make such a request. Fisher explained that the tenant was dead. He assigned Faden to track down the owners, who lived an hour away in Grass Valley. In the meantime, Fisher, who also functions as the county coroner, announced Miller's death on Facebook, writing, "Preliminary investigation indicates that she passed away prior to the bear's involvement," adding that the bear may have been drawn by the scent or by other factors. Fisher's working theory was not implausible. Miller had significant health problems, and no one on record had ever been killed by a black bear in California. Black bears had killed about 60 people since 1900 in all of North America. Miller had been dead for nearly a week, but her body was still awaited autopsy in the morgue in Placer County, which encompasses part of Lake Tahoe. "Any update on the bear lady?" Fisher asked the medical examiner, Kelly Koblansky, in an email on November 15th. "I'm fighting with Fish and Wildlife regarding the bear. They're dragging their feet, wanting confirmation she didn't die as a result of a bear attack." By this point, Faden had found the landlords, who requested a depredation permit. Fish and Wildlife granted it, and a trapper planted a ventilated cage baited with marshmallows and fish in Miller's driveway. The following morning, Koblansky replied to Fisher, writing, "I think the bear attack was most likely postmortem. He's probably been eating her garbage that she leaves outside her window every night, and this night maybe she forgot, maybe because she was dead, to put the beam against it. And he noticed she was lying peacefully on her bed. The examination had shown heart disease, renal failure, cirrhosis, a nasty liver," Koblansky added, "not to mention terrible teeth," or tooth, I should say. The trap at Miller's house caught a bear the next day. Fisher met the wildlife biologist there. The lab had found that the DNA on Miller's body belonged to a male bear. The biologist said the bear in the trap appeared to be female. "Tranquilize it, lift its leg and check," the sheriff suggested. The biologist wasn't certified in what Fish and Wildlife calls chemical immobilization, and according to the agency, was not able to or authorized to tranquilize the bear. It became clear that the state intended to let the bear go, so the sheriff seized and padlocked the cage. When the state ordered him to release the bear, Fisher said that he'd do so only after calling a TV station to document what was happening. I was told that I was grandstanding, that I was being inhumane to this bear, and that I needed to release it immediately, he later said during a radio interview. Fish and Wildlife sent for a properly certified biologist who, after administering the tranquilizer, revealed that the bear was male. Its testicles were undescended, which may have explained the confusion. The bear was shot that night. Fisher said public safety is number one. Wildlife management is number two. The biologist swabbed the bear's cheek and drew a blood sample, then sent the materials to the forensics lab to see if the bear that they'd just euthanized was the one whose DNA had been found on Miller. Fisher was still waiting for the results when, on December 14th, Koblansky, who hadn't yet signed off on her autopsy report, emailed again to say that a colleague had reviewed some of Miller's injuries. We both agree that, while most of the injuries appear to be inflicted post-mortem, the hemorrhage in the neck wound makes that more suspicious. It is possible the one swipe at the neck killed her, and he enjoyed his cash in the following days. I can't be positive, but I'm prepared to call it probable bear mauling with extensive post-mortem predation or something to that effect. Koblansky signed her report on January 4th, listing Miller's cause of death as perforating sharp and blunt force crushing injuries consistent with bear mauling and subsequent predation. The report did not indicate whether death was instantaneous, only that Miller was alive when the bear struck. Koblansky is no longer employed by Placer County, and she did not respond to my attempts to reach her. Fisher was looking at evidence of the first confirmed killing of a human by a black bear in California, and he still didn't know for sure whether they had put down the right animal. Fish and Wildlife was requesting a copy of the autopsy report, but he didn't want to provide it until the agency sent the DNA results. The impasse was ongoing, and the public was unaware of it, when in mid-May, an elderly man woke up from a nap and found a bear standing in his living room. Fisher, having flashbacks to Miller, declared the bear a threat to public safety. Then a bear tried to get inside a Downeyville school while kids were present. Deputies tracked it down and shot it. Fisher was irritated with Fish and Wildlife, later saying, "It shouldn't have to fall on the local sheriff to do their job." On May 21st, the Mountain Messenger published a front-page story about Fisher's frustrations. The next day, state wildlife officials sat down with the sheriff in a meeting attended by Sierra County Assemblywoman Megan Dale. Only then did they exchange information about the bear that had been euthanized at Miller's house. It was, as Fisher had suspected all along, the one that killed her. The state appeared to have known this since November 2023. According to lab notes that I obtained through a public records request, a lab tech wrote on November 20th, complete profile of male bear consistent with profile detected on deceased. The public and the sheriff began to learn the fuller story 6 months after the fact. Devin Baroni had just started her job at Bear League. She and Bryant wondered why the pathologist's conclusions didn't match Fisher's original statement. Autopsies and other forensic findings can contradict conclusions drawn by a county coroner. The inconsistencies and the long wait for answers convinced Bryant and Baroni that someone was hiding something. They didn't know that part of the murkiness was due to the communication breakdown between the sheriff and the state. Fisher, who grew up in Downeyville and has worked for the Sierra County Sheriff's Office for 24 years, was contending with a more intense bear situation than he had ever seen. In June, a bear turned up at a wedding and destroyed a car, ran off with somebody's luggage, and came back for the reception. Between July 18th and August 2nd, his office received 34 calls about one or more bears in Downeyville, Sierra City, Loyalton, and other communities in his jurisdiction. Bears were trying to get into homes and into a resort cabin at Sierra Shangri-La. A caller who reported a bear trapped inside his Chevy Equinox got mad when the 911 dispatcher, who had no available deputies to send, suggested opening the door and letting the bear out. A woman found a bear swimming in a neighbor's pool. A bear walked up to a barbecue and ran off when somebody rang a cowbell. At about 3 o'clock one morning, a woman fired a rifle from her front door after a bear tried to get inside. She could see the door being pulled, the dispatcher noted. The sheriff and state wildlife officials started meeting every other week. Their relationship vastly improved. A spokesman for Fish and Wildlife told me that the agency's complex task of protecting both humans and animals and preventing deaths like Miller's depends in part on educating and encouraging Californians. In late October, nearly a year after Miller's death, state biologists and game wardens traveled to Downeyville to appear with Fisher at a town hall. Fisher assured the audience, "Do I think that every bear that comes into our town is a threat to public safety? No." A state supervisor explained that the crux of the problem was access to human food. "Bleach your garbage cans," he said. "Take in your Halloween pumpkins." Fisher, without mentioning Miller, suggested that residents encourage one another to keep their property clean. "We the people need to take responsibility, and we need to speak up if our neighbors are, you know, living like slobs," he said. I'd been in Downeyville weeks earlier, and I had not seen or heard of anyone using bear mats or wires. I saw only a couple of bear boxes. Both were downtown, and one had been left ajar. A well-defended property would have mats, wires, and a bear box, which altogether would cost upward of several thousand dollars. The per capita income in Sierra County is less than $38,000 a year. Miller's house was still boarded up. It had been gutted by a hazmat team hired by the owner's insurance company. The yard was overgrown. The cats were gone. Miller's body had been cremated by the Chapel of the Angels. "I am still convinced that the bear did not kill her," Bryant said when I called her in November. But the bear did kill Miller, according to the autopsy report, even if it hadn't come for her. Bryant was as heartbroken for Miller as she was for the bears. "People are going to be more fearful rather than getting a grip on their fears," she said. She ended our call, she often did. "Stay safe." Paige Williams, a staff writer, writes U.S. Journal, a series that Calvin Trillin created in The New Yorker in 1967. She is the author of The Dinosaur Artist and the winner of the 2024 Mirror Award. The current cinema, Wicked and Gladiator 2, offer nostalgic, half-satisfying showdowns. With the musical return to Oz and a bloody epic of ancient Rome, Hollywood studios double down on blockbuster spectacle by Justin Chang. One of the movie industry's many recent laments is that 2024 has given us no Barbenheimer, no box office showdown between two thrillingly brainy blockbusters, cemented together in the cultural imagination and the commercial stratosphere. And yet, just in time for Thanksgiving, here comes two wishfully galumping epics, Wicked and Gladiator 2. One is a revisionist fantasy of Oz, the other a revisionist history of Rome, and both are chock-a-block with political conspiracies, authoritarian abuses, and foul-tempered monkeys, none of which adds up to a full-blown phenomenon. If Barbie and Oppenheimer struck blows for risk and originality in Hollywood, the slickly refurbished wares of Wadiator, or if you prefer, Glicked, suggest a safe retreat to known quantities. Choose your own adventure, but whether it leads to the Colosseum or to the Emerald City, you've surely been there before. In Wicked, or as it appears on screen, Wicked Part 1, the familiarity is entirely the point. The movie, directed by John M. Chu, with some of the whirligig showmanship he brought to In the Heights 2021 and Crazy Rich Asians 2018, kicks off a two-part adaptation of a hit Broadway musical, which was itself loosely based on Gregory Maguire's 1995 novel, Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West. All yellow brick roads lead back to L. Frank Baum's The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, though the classic 1939 film adaptation exerts the mightiest influence, having immortalized the Wicked Witch as a green-skinned broomstick-riding cackler played by Margaret Hamilton in one of the most primally terrifying movie villain performances. Even this delectable can no longer be simply savored. It must be deconstructed and lucratively prequelized in the manner of sympathetic villain origin stories like Maleficent, Joker, and Cruella. It makes sense that Wicked, a forerunner of this trend on the page and the stage, has now found its place on the screen, where the story can shoulder its full weight in cinematic bombast, and so the real Wicked Witch steps out from behind the curtain, and lo, she is Elphaba Tropp, Cynthia Erivo, an intellectually gifted, morally courageous, and grievously misunderstood outcast, whose only crime is having been born with the complexion of chlorophyll. Much of part one, scripted by Winnie Holtzman, who wrote the book for the musical, and Dana Fox, unfolds at the ill-named Shiz University, Hogwarts with Munchkins, where Elphaba arrives as a caregiver for her newly enrolled sister, Nessa Rose, Marissa Bode, who has a disability, but Elphaba's irrepressible talents catch the attention of the school's headmistress, Madame Morrible, Michelle Yeoh, prompting a rivalry with Galinda, Ariana Grande, billed as Aria Grande Butera, a shallow, self-absorbed classmate who will eventually become Glinda, the Good Witch of the North. Elphaba and Galinda are forced to be roommates, and they go together like asparagus and bubblegum. But Glinda is more than just a walking dumb blonde joke. She's the secret socioeconomic weapon of Wicked, and Grande balances her delightful queen bee insouciance with the porcelain vulnerability worthy of Baum's own China princess. Beneath every exaggerated hair toss, she unleashes a poignant frisson of panic. When the two witches finally set their differences aside, cue popular, the deftest and funniest of Stephen Schwartz's songs, Galinda's joy is unfeigned. Her friendship with Elfie fills a real void. And Riva makes you believe it. Her coolly magnetic stare is her on-screen superpower, and here it serves to modulate the narrative clutter swirling around her. As a fastidiously retconned Wizard of Oz prequel, Wicked has its puzzle blocks pleasures. The uninitiated can muse over the narrative significance of, say, a terrified lion cub, a bicycle basket, or a hunky prince, an assured Jonathan Bailey, who foretells his future with the lyric, "Life is painless for the brainless." As a parable of political radicalization, however, the movie soon turns lumbering and obvious. Oz is in the grip of creeping totalitarianism, and the more Elphaba grasps the stakes, the more pointed the hat she has to wear become. She's a feminist crusader, an animal welfare activist, and in time, a full-blown resistance leader, with the not-so-wonderful Wizard of Oz, a well-cast Jeff Goldblum, as her target. Given the story's insistence on not judging a witch by her color, it is churlish to say that I wish Wicked Part 1 looked better, and also that at 2 hours and 40 minutes that there were less of it to look at. The visual bar here is admittedly high. No new movie can be expected to match the dazzling technicolor brilliance of The Wizard of Oz, a picture I've seen so many times that even its flaws feel like old friends. The lopped-off lines, the mismatched edits, the shot in which Hamilton's witch, about to vanish in a poof of smoke, misses her mark by a second or two. These imperfections, far from diminishing the experience, give the older film a material weight, a conviction about its own magic, for which the pristine digital surfaces of Wicked can conjure no equivalent. It's not easy being green-screened, but even so, there is little in this movie's muted palette and washed-out backlighting to make you muse for even a second. What a world. What a world. Near the end, though, Wicked does surge to a kind of life. The climax is protracted, but darkly thrilling. Ugly secrets spill into the open, winged monkeys screech and scratter, and Elphaba comes into full possession of her powers. It's time to try defying gravity, she belts to the skies. And the film shrewdly follows suit with a vertiginous airborne number that doesn't feel like Oz. It feels like Vegas. You want to see it projected onto the sphere, perhaps with Elphaba soaring on a rhinestone-studded broomstick and then leaving the Emerald City in the dust. Part 2 looms next year. Until then, Elfie has left the building. The lesson of Wicked should you happen to miss it is that the appearance of villainy can be deceiving. Gladiator 2, in its own punchy, stabby, neck-chomping way, upholds the same principle. Directed by Ridley Scott nearly a quarter century after he steered the first Gladiator 2000 to smash returns and Oscar glory, this is the sword and sandal epic as both sequel and shell game. Clean, good versus evil demarcations are a thing of the past, and motives and alliances can be murderously tricky to suss out. The hero, at least, is no mystery. He is Lucius Paul Mescal, a fierce young warrior of Nemedia, who, after experiencing crushing defeat and tragic personal loss, is hauled off to Rome as a prisoner of war. Soon he will be a gladiator in the Colosseum, where a bloody quest for vengeance begins. And that's all we have time for today. By Justin Chang. Justin Chang is a film critic at The New Yorker. He won the 2024 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.